From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
I'm asking that we approach this session and this budget in a spirit of authentic bipartisan collaboration.
We're expected to just wait and see what they have as a plan. Meanwhile, millions of people will be left without health care.
Some of the report was made public last week, but we're learning tonight about a portion that wasn't released. It suggests Russia may have information that could potentially be compromising to President-elect Trump.
I do have one final ask of you as your president. The same thing I asked when you took a chance on me 8 years ago. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to bring about change, but in yours.
You can join our conversation about the news of the week, and there has been an awful lot of news, actually, just in the last 24 hours, let alone the week. You can call us at 860-275-7266. Again, it's 860-275-7266. You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as he always does on Wednesdays, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and we'll be telling you more about some special Colin McEnroe Show programming coming up later today. Colin, hello. Good morning,
Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror at ctmirror.org. Hi there, Paz.
Good morning.
And Suzanne Bates is here. She's Policy Director of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello once again, Suzanne.
Good morning.
So, Colin, let's start with the thing we heard most recently. President Obama gave his farewell address to the nation last night. It was, as he usually does, a beautifully written and constructed speech. It was beautifully delivered in front of a somewhat delirious crowd of about 18,000 people. What are some of the things you pulled out of this last time that we're going to hear President Obama speak on a stage like this?
There was so much. And you know, Bill Clinton is probably the best speaker among modern presidents, going back to Ronald Reagan anyway. I think Obama might be the best writer. And you can tell he writes a lot of his own stuff, too. Obviously, he's written two very good books as well. And a lot of what you heard in the speech last night had his cadences, his particular kinds of flourishes. I'm guessing he had a pretty heavy hand in writing the speech. Actually, one of the better observations I saw on Twitter was from Carolyn Payne, who regularly appears on The Nose on my show. She says the Obama farewell is like Captain Von Trapp at the end of Sound of Music. Heartbroken for his country, he'll sing us one last beautiful song before leaving. Hopefully, President Obama is not fleeing over the Alps. In fact, he says in the speech that he's going to stick around as a citizen. He is going to be part of the national conversation. Maybe that's the biggest message from last night. I thought it was a pretty remarkable speech in its ability to combine two things that Obama does pretty well. A lot of times, he's sort of the coolest, smartest professor you ever had. I mean, he's really good in a professorial way of kind of laying out some fairly complicated ideas in a way that you can kind of take notes on without getting lost. You know, and then he has a little bit of the preacher in him, too. And I do think he preached last night. And then lastly, and this is maybe the thing that President Obama doesn't typically do, he made a lot of people cry as he began talking about his wife and his kids and even talking about Joe Biden. I mean, people were just, they were, you know, bawling in the audience. And if you went on social media, people were crying. You know, so one of the things that has been fairly or unfairly a trope about President Obama is that he's a little bit distant from his emotions. He you know, more than teared up talking about Michelle Obama.
But I'm glad you said that, though, because I was going to bring that up with you, Colin. He has always been said to be distant from his emotions, the emotion that brings sadness and tears, but also the emotion that gets you riled up and gets you angry. And in some ways, this was the typical and perfect Barack Obama speech in that he exudes this feeling of hope that we are going to move on together. But an awful lot of the people in the audience last night, an awful lot of people in America, aren't actually where he is on this, right? They're angry. They're upset. They want something different. And he gave them exactly what Barack Obama always gives them, which is kind of a soothing, we're going to continue to move forward speech while a lot of people are angry and looking for something else.
Well, I mean, in his defense, first of all, it's really easy to make people angry. And we know that because we just watched a political campaign where
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Won an election basically making people angry every single day, having a very little substance behind it, you know, just getting people really angry. That would have been a very easy thing for President Obama to do last night, too, say these things are outrageous. He's not even been sworn in yet. Look what he's already doing. You know, I mean, that would have been a pretty easy thing for him to do. It's not his style. I don't think it's also particularly presidential to do that. I think ultimately he did lay out kind of a matrix for understanding things that might go wrong, ways in which, you know, the basic American dream may be under assault in certain ways. His biggest applause line, I think, was the thing about, you know, not directing prejudice against American Muslims.
Yes.
I don't think he got a bigger hand for anything. And boy, that's pretty clear what he's talking about. I mean, who might he be referring to in terms of directing any kinds of attacks on a religious minority? So, you know, it was there, and I think it would have been wrong for it to be waving, you know, the flag of aggression too much more than that.
Well, if you want to be influential, if you want to expand your audience, you cannot speak down to people. You cannot attack people. So I think that speech last night was, yes, an expression of brotherhood with the people who had elected him twice and who had worked for him. But more than that, I think he was speaking to the nation. It was, after all, a presidential farewell address. The history of these things, with probably two exceptions, is largely forgettable. You know, we have George Washington's first farewell, which President Obama quoted from last night, I think, very effectively. Then you have Dwight Eisenhower's really interesting warning about the moment in time he existed in, warning about the rise of the military-industrial complex, and which really was code for big money and influence. By the way, a warning, as it history will tell us, was not particularly well heeded. So while Dwight Eisenhower was talking about the military-industrial complex, you know, President Obama was warning about these bubbles of information that we all live in. You know, we all have our own social media feeds. We all watch our own cable TV shows, or at least some of us do. I find it easier to resist watching those shows in recent months. But there were a couple of things that were jarring, though, and that the president felt a need to defend science and reason. You know, this was a day in which Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was seen leaving Trump Tower, and he was there to discuss an investigation of vaccines. RFK Jr. is a well-known vaccine doubter who has gone against, you know, the body of scientific and medical research to assert connections between vaccines and autism. So all these speeches need to be read in the moment in which they're delivered. We'll see if this one has any legs if we look back on this 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, and will we find that it resonated, and was it heard beyond the audience in McCormick Place?
Actually, as you bring up the military-industrial complex and think about what 60 years later or whatever it is, things indeed have not changed. I guess you wonder if anything that he's saying right now will not have changed so substantively again in another 50 or 60
actually,
years.
Actually, I would, you know, the beauty of the internet, it's easy enough to Google these things. I would urge your listeners to Google that speech. It was an incredible speech, and he did talk about the place in the United States, about the need to reach out to nations and peoples of all races, all faiths, all beliefs, and that the United States' position in the world. It is a speech that clearly stands up over time.
So, Suzanne, what did you take out of last night?
You know, I'm someone who hasn't appreciated everything that President Obama has done. I don't agree with a lot of his policies. I have seen him as more divisive than I think a lot of people on the left see him as. But I think we can all appreciate the historical nature of his presidency. And yes, that he's a very graceful speaker. And, you know, I mean, I was hopeful last night that we can all get out of our bubbles and reach you know, across the aisle and try and talk to each other more. I think, too, he said something interesting on the Affordable Care Act, which is, you know, sort of one of his biggest legacies, which will likely be dismantled in the next couple years. You know, that if the Republicans can come up with something that is better, leads to cheaper health care and more people getting coverage, that he will support it and cheer for it. And I hope he does if that does happen. And I think there are a lot of good ideas on the right now about health care and how to make things better. So you know, I appreciate, you know, his speech and what he said, but
And we're going to actually loop back to the ACA in just a little bit, because it is one of the things that's happening right now with all of these other backdrops. But I guess, Colin, we have to move to the juxtaposition of President Obama's speech last night with the other news that we were getting, that the chiefs of America's intelligence agencies had briefed President Obama and President-elect Trump with a summary of unsubstantiated reports that Russia had collected compromising and salacious personal information about Mr. Trump. So here's the deal, Colin. Usually when we talk about stuff that is potentially salacious, it's with a backdrop of, oh, my goodness, I can't believe that that could possibly have happened. That is indeed salacious. But it only feels like it barely even moves the needle compared to some of what else we've said or heard over the course of the past year. Secondly, this notion of unsubstantiated reports is something that whether it was the intelligence community or it was mainstream news organizations, we're always very, very careful with. And now we are just widely talking about unsubstantiated reports about salacious details. I'm not sure what all we could and should be talking about around this. What seems pretty clear is that this is, again, another piece of connection between Donald Trump and Russia, and potentially a very damning one.
Yeah. So, I mean, just on a kind of almost personal level, I mean, no one should feel sorry for Donald Trump to be smeared in this way. This is the guy who, with even less substantiation, led the birther movement against Barack Obama. This is the guy with no substantiation who suggested that Ted Cruz's father was involved in the assassination of JFK. So, I mean, as journalists and as American citizens, we can have problems with the way this is being released and whether or not it rises to the level of discussable truth or discussable possibility. But on a personal level, I'm happy to see him. I'm going to say this. I'm happy to see him twisting in this kind of wind. It is the kind of wind that has been blowing out of his mouth for the last 15 or 20 years. He's used it against all kinds of people. And now, I mean, he can suffer. Now, setting that aside, this. Setting that aside. I mean, one thing about this is the intelligence community doesn't. I mean, I don't know whether this stuff is true or not. I don't even really care, at least about the really salacious stuff, whether it's true or not. The intelligence community typically doesn't brief the president-elect and the sitting president about stuff that is just wildly, you know, some crazy thing that can't possibly be true or has no meat on its bones whatsoever. So their assessment of this is that it rises to the level of something that the president-elect and president should know about. You know, which once again lifts it a little bit higher than Ted Cruz's father or Obama not being born here. You know, beyond that, I think the larger question, I don't really care what happened in the Ritz-Carlton Moscow, but I mean, the larger question is what kinds of activities were going on between Donald Trump and the Russian government or Donald Trump's representatives in the Russian government, because some of those can begin to creep into the area of treason. So people are kind of focusing I guess we'll keep using the word salacious instead of some of the more visceral ways of talking about
it. I'll get out a thesaurus. We can figure out some more words for it. But
I don't care about that. But, I mean, if he's, you know, if it turns out that he was actively involved or his representatives were actively involved in working with the Russian government to in any way kind of subvert the activities of the American election, you know, he could have a much bigger problem than, you know, the Ritz-Carlton.
The challenge for the press and the challenge for the American public is going to be to separate out very serious questions of espionage by Russia, what's real, what isn't, and separate it out from the context of, is this an attack on the legitimacy of Donald Trump as president? Because we'll give Colin his moment to enjoy his little bit of schadenfreude to watch Trump sort of hoisted by his own petard. But the serious thing here is going to be, can we get past the construct that you're either with Trump or you're against Trump as you try to evaluate these, quite frankly, crazy-ass stories? And because there's a very serious, serious element to this, the extent to which a foreign power through use of espionage, through use of manipulating the media, through the use of hacking, have they attempted to influence an election and quite possibly an administration? This needs to be examined in a very sober way, and I'm not sure we're set up to do it right now.
Yeah. Are we set up to do it right now? And when you hear things like this, I mean, we are going to hear a press conference from Donald Trump at 11 o'clock today. And one of my first thoughts, Suzanne, is the timing on this is so interesting because you feel as though if indeed a press conference happens at 11 o'clock today, that so many details will be on the salacious details, as opposed to the very real questions that we need to have answered here. Once again, we're going to, as a country, somewhat against what President Obama was asking for last night, going to go down into the mud and down into the gutter, as opposed to lifting ourselves up a little bit.
Right. And I think we need to be so careful about what we assume and what we take, you know, as truth versus, you know, what might be misleading. This is a report from one guy out of Russia. I read the BuzzFeed article last night, but not all of the details. But, you know, this is a report, one guy out of Russia. And so you look at the Washington Post story from a couple of weeks ago about how Russia hacked Vermont's electrical grid. And then all of a sudden, oh, that never mind. That's not true. Sometimes you lose your credibility if you keep rushing to judgment and keep putting out things that are not true, right, in rushing to judgment on somebody.
But I think to Colin's earlier point is right now, this is the first time in history, I think, we have a president-elect who regularly goes in public and says things that he has no substantiation for on a constant basis. I mean, this is the thing that put him into the political spotlight was the birther movement.
I'm not going to try and defend President-elect Trump on, you know, some of these his Twitter feed. That's not what I'm interested in doing.
The birther movement was not just his Twitter feed. This was long before he became a Twitter star. And let's also keep in mind that the standard that he applied at that time, if it were applied to him now, it would be completely – the burden would be on him right now to prove that all of this stuff isn't true, and we wouldn't accept the first round of proof. That's certainly the way he treated Obama's birth status, right?
Sure.
That the burden was on Obama to prove that he hadn't been born somewhere else, and the first round of documents were not enough, more needed to be done. That's the world he wants to live in. Look good. Let him live in it for a while.
Sure. And I think that several Republican senators have said that they are willing and want to look into these things. And I think that's good, and we should. But I think this constant hysteria on the left, I mean, I feel like people are starting to get hysteria fatigue, you know, and you become numb to it after a while because it's this constant drumbeat of hysteria. And when something real does come up, kind of like Mark was saying, are we even going to recognize it? Because you become numb to it after a while.
And I'll just say, and I'm glad that Suzanne brought up that Washington Post article. We're covering that a little bit in my show next this week. The story about a Vermont utility and whether or not it got hacked. The Washington Post sort of has to walk it back later. The worry about what we're talking about, Paz, for our industry is that now this standard has been so degraded that if anybody says it in the world and someone has tweeted about it, then it requires full coverage from the traditional news media. And sometimes the news media gets it wrong. And now we go down a path in which truth doesn't even matter anymore. And that's a very scary world for me.
There's no book on how to cover Donald J. Trump. You know, right? He's been elected. We're still trying to figure it out. The only parallel I can find in history that I can think of is how the press dealt with Joseph McCarthy. Trump people listening, you know, I'm not drawing the perfect parallel, but what I'm talking about is McCarthy's use of the media. And the media at the time, using the conventions of the time, didn't know what the hell to do with this guy. And Edward R. Murrow, who ultimately played a major role in taking him down, he kind of violated some of the journalistic tenets of the time in doing so. I think it's a very relevant chapter in history of American journalism and American politics, because that's where we are. And Trump is somebody who almost needs a psychologist to kind of get him past viewing everything in terms of self, in terms of an attack on him. And I don't know how we do that.
You could have actually stopped that sentence earlier, Paz. I'm not going to tell you where. We're going to take a break, and we've actually got a few things to cover. I will say that the very helpful Kion Wolf has given us some thesaurus words for salacious: lewd, indecent, obscene, prurient, body, carnal, erotic, and lecherous. So we can work those in as we continue to talk about this throughout the course of the hour.
I'm all for kinky.
I'm joined by
urological seems to apply.
Mark Bastiokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Suzanne Bates, Policy Director of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. A little bit more to talk about what was happening in Washington yesterday and a lot about what happened in Hartford last week. That's coming up next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror at ctmirror.org, and also Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, could you explain what's going on this afternoon? I'm going to be helping you with the program today, and there's a lot happening, of course.
Right. We decided that since this will be the president-elect's first press conference in many, many, many days, that we should just react directly to it. So presumably he'll be done by 1 o'clock, and we'll do that. Joining us will be you. Lou Weicker, former governor and former U.S. senator. John Cleese. I feel like we needed like a comedian somehow, just so John Cleese is joining us. And Alicia Krauss, who's a conservative talk show host that we've done a lot of stuff with and whom we like a lot.
So that's all coming up at 1 o'clock. And
well,
just
wait a minute. John Cleese?
John Cleese is going to be on the show today.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, seriously.
Okay.
He just sort of threw that in. So as a quick program note.
Because who knows what he's going to say at the press conference. He could announce that Grayson Allen is up for a, you know, cabinet post or something.
That's coming up at 1 o'clock. I will say as a program note, that program is going to be rebroadcast at 7 o'clock tonight on WNPR. And then it will be followed at 8 o'clock by special NPR coverage of basically all this other stuff that's going on. So listen for a rebroadcast of Colin McEnroe at 7 o'clock tonight, where we usually hear this show. And then at 8 o'clock, a special from NPR. Boy, there's a lot.
You could also watch this show, which you won't hear at 7 o'clock, on CTN.
Oh, that's right.
Where you can see John Dankosky's hand signals for all this stuff that's going on.
So just please write that down and make sure to consult your local listings. A lot of other things happened yesterday in Washington we're going to get through before we move to Hartford. Here's actually Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal yesterday during a back and forth about gun control. This was at the Senate confirmation hearings for Jeff Sessions, a Senate colleague who is, of course, up to be Attorney General.
Will you support laws necessary to effectively apply those laws, including universal background checks that are necessary to know whether the purchaser is a felon or a drug addict or a domestic abuser?
Well, I believe in background check laws, and many of them are appropriate. But in every instance, there are some instances when it's not practical. Like, say, for example, somebody inherited a gun from their grandfather. Those transactions, I'm not sure, should require that kind of universal background check.
So Richard Blumenthal said he was going to ask that question about gun control. He asked some other questions, Colin. I mean, Senator Blumenthal, of course, took a little bit of a backseat role to Patrick Leahy and others who were grilling Jeff Sessions. We were watching that all throughout the day. Did Sessions say anything that was surprising to you?
Well, it depends what you mean by surprising. I just want to quickly say the example that he just gave. So that's, I don't know, Adam Lanza inherits a gun from somebody, you know, that's not worth a background check. So I think universal background checks make a lot of sense. Americans support them. I don't think it really would be that hard to flag them in wills and stuff like that and say, no, let's see who's getting this gun. Is he, you know, a dangerous person? I mean, Adam Lanza is a great example of that. The guns were kind of in the family. So setting that aside. So, yeah, Blumenthal, he pushed pretty hard. There was a gasp in the audience. He asked Jeff Sessions, I don't know what this pertains to, whether Jeff Sessions had ever won an award from the Ku Klux Klan. It's the kind of question you usually don't ask unless you have some reason to think that it's true. Sessions' answer, I think, was, well, you know, you win a lot of awards. Who knows, you know? Anyway, I would say that we know pretty much who Jeff Sessions is and what his policies are. Some of the things that maybe jumped out yesterday that aren't surprises necessarily, but as the entire political establishment, conservative and liberal, has kind of moved forward towards this notion of having fewer people in prisons, of finding other ways to deal with minor crimes, Sessions seems like a real outlier. You know, yesterday he repeated this notion that, you know, he considers marijuana to be something that, you know, he would prosecute, marijuana use maybe even something that he would prosecute. This just seems so far outside, not, you know, and not any particular political stripe, but everybody's. He also, a little bit disturbingly, I think it was in response to a Feinstein question, said that he also feels as though there may be instances in which Americans could be held and detained without charges. I'm not a big fan of that. I never have been. So I don't know. I mean, he's a very problematic attorney general nominee, but we knew that before yesterday.
But this hearing really wasn't about
his qualifications. It was about establishing a record and trying to – a record that you can hold him to going forward. The assumption is he will be confirmed. So they did get a very strong statement against torture and waterboarding, which puts him in line with General Mattis, who undoubtedly will be confirmed as defense secretary, and with the many, many, many generals who have signed a letter urging President-elect Trump not to reverse U.S. policy and, in fact, law against torture. It is something that puts U.S. service men and women in jeopardy if they are captured. That is one of the rationales behind it. And most of the professionals believe it's ineffective. So there was that. But we have to keep in mind that in most cases, these hearings are not about whether or not somebody actually will be confirmed for the office, but it's going to be to illuminate their record and what we might expect from them.
Yeah, I was heartened by the hearing yesterday. I don't agree with everything Senator Sessions says, but I think he put a lot of the fears to rest yesterday that people had. I was heartened, too, to see that Senator Susan Collins of Maine introduced him and, you know, do some pretty glowing words to describe him. You know, she said that he was, you know, personally a good friend and that she can vouch confidently for the fact that Jeff Sessions is a person of integrity and a principled leader. You know, I think people... Susan Collins is one of those people you trust. She's not. She's seen as a moderate. So I think that was good. And you know, on the marijuana issue, I mean, I think one of the things Senator Sessions said yesterday is it's not his job to make the laws. That's Congress's job. And if we really want some movement on some of these marijuana issues, then that's their job. You know, and it's his job to implement the laws.
Well, but there's a lot of gray area on what the feds can do, given the disconnect between state laws and federal law on marijuana.
But the states continue to move forward with their own marijuana laws, and now we have more than just a handful of states that seem to, in one way or another, run right up against federal law in what they're allowing people to do in the state, it seems as though it might push us towards some sort of congressional action on this. I mean, to have these two things disconnected, I almost feel like that's a good answer from the Attorney General, because the Attorney General should probably be saying, I will prosecute laws, but we better have better damn laws in the books than the ones we got right now.
It really is an untenable situation, this conflict between federal and state law. You know, Connecticut's medical marijuana program operates with kind of a wink and a nod about how it started, because there was no really legal way to import the first marijuana seeds that have developed the product. But I don't know if this Congress is going to be the one that's going to take that on and say, let's bring some rationality to marijuana laws.
Well, maybe this is a chance for, you know, conservatives to tout their federalism, you know, states' rights, and maybe it's time to change those laws. You know, I think we need to have that conversation about whether marijuana, the legalization is good. I mean, look, we have a record now of what's been going on in Colorado. So I think there's a chance now we can have that conversation.
Yeah, I think clarity is going to come in the form of practice, but that could be a little bit alarming. I think people are genuinely confused right now, and I'm probably more concerned about the criminal justice aspect of this. I mean, I just don't want to see a lot of people getting locked up. I mean, I just think that was insanity. We went through that. It was expensive. It wrecked lives. But there are other questions. I mean, yeah, in terms of the state-federal conflict, I mean, are dispensaries going to be subject to federal intervention? I don't think we really know.
Sessions was one of the senators, though, who did acknowledge the error of the sentencing guidelines of the mid-'80s in which crack was treated, you know, as far, far more severely than other cocaine. And he did agree to the rollback of that sentencing. So this isn't somebody who has just been rigidly ideological in looking at drug laws. So we'll see if data actually convinces him to, you know, to take another approach to this.
We mentioned the Affordable Care Act earlier. Congress has taken steps toward repealing the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut on Thursday was on the front lines of Democratic efforts to stop or slow the process, but he was not able to persuade a single Republican senator to support his amendment.
This is absolutely extraordinary. We got sworn in less than a week ago. The new president has not even been inaugurated. There isn't even a conceptual plan for what will replace the Affordable Care Act. And we are rushing forward with repeal. There is an enthusiasm to this cruelty.
I just have to, there's an enthusiasm to this cruelty is not a bad line. But so, Colin, I mean, what we've even heard since then is now all of a sudden a whole series of Republicans standing up and going, look, this might not work. Trump himself saying we're going to have to replace it with something. We can't just repeal it and let nothing happen and kick millions and millions of people off of health care.
There's a lot of things going on here. And yeah, one of the part of the five Republicans was Susan Collins again, I think. But the kind of wild, keep your eye on Lamar Alexander. So like buried yesterday between salacious Trump stuff and Obama's amazing speech. And, you know, Alexander, who has a pretty key committee position on all this, he kind of explained better than I've heard anybody do how you might have to do this and how you might have to go in and repair some of the state exchanges, you know, to keep them going. And it really was the first grown-up explanation of how to do this that I've really seen. Now, there's a couple of other things going on here. First of all, there's political consequences to all this. I mean, people hate Obamacare, but they love the Affordable Care Act, right? So there's a lot of people who are benefiting a lot in a lot of different ways who, no matter what they say to pollsters or what they say on social media, they may not be all that happy if a lot of this stuff goes away. And believe me, senators and Congress members are thinking about that and are aware of that. The other thing, and you and I were talking about this morning, was is that, you know, this is a way in which the Trump administration doesn't seem to understand congressional procedure very well. And that's a problem. Reagan was successful because the people around him understood congressional procedure. So Trump is on record, you know, as of yesterday or in the front page of the New York Times this morning saying, no, I want it repealed and replaced now. Well, there is no such thing as now, probably. I mean, you look at the stuff that the moderate Republicans are saying. You look at what Alexander's saying. That probably can't happen. And in general, you don't want to be a guy who hasn't even been sworn in getting into these really kind of snippy standoffs about stuff you're asking for that isn't even remotely practical, particularly in the face of some pushback from your own party. You know, I mean, he's got to learn to listen to these people.
Suzanne?
I think people are going to do – I think the Republicans are going to do this in a smart way. I think there are a lot of great ideas on the right about how – what to replace the Affordable Care Act with. And I think, look, you've seen election after election since this law happened. The American people have spoken. They hate it. They hate it. It is not – it's not working. It's – healthcare is getting more expensive. Yes, we were able to expand accessibility a little bit. But it's really been a disaster for many families.
Tens of millions of people isn't a little bit. I mean, that's people who didn't have health insurance before.
In the context of the American population, it's a small move in the
needle.
If you're
one of the tens of millions of people, it's probably a pretty good thing for you,
right? Sure, yes.
And I think, to Colin's point, it's a little bit of a joke, but it's true. One of the things we hear is people really do hate Obamacare. They can't stand Obamacare. They're not sure that it's different than the ACA or the same thing. And that's one of the problems if you talk to people over and over again. So what's one of the really good plans out there on the right? What's something that's going
to
work?
Oh, I think being able to buy health care from across the nation, opening up, you know, instead of just being able to buy it in your state, being able to buy it, you know, taking down some of those barriers. I think we need more transparency in terms of our medical costs. I think there are all kinds of ideas that are cropping up that will actually get at the growing cost of health care and the confusion. I mean, look, people are getting dumped off their plans. I mean, and the Affordable Care Act didn't just have health care issues. It affected your workplace, your employment. A lot of workplaces cut back people's hours so that they were under that magical 30-hour mark so that they didn't have to give them health care. I mean, it had so many facets that were frustrating to people. And I think hopefully we're going to see a big change.
Can I just speak to the people hate it thing? I've pulled up the Real Clear Politics average, and it's for it is 45.7, against is 49.3. To me, that is not an indication of hate. And then if you look at the trend lines are running up on the approval level. In other words, right now, the number of people who approve seems to be going up, and going up kind of dramatically, maybe because they think it's about to be taken away. But I don't think it's quite fair to say people hate this. Well, yeah, some people hate it. Some people really like it. It's about a 3-point difference between hate and likes.
Well, and to clarify, I think there were parts of it they hate, and then parts of it, you know, like the you can't kick people off with pre-existing conditions. You know, some of the expansions for young people. There were things that people liked. But yeah. then there was a lot that people didn't like, and I think we've seen that at the ballot box. I mean, that's been a big issue in every election since it passed.
What they don't understand is, I mean, the thing that everybody hates is the employer mandate, right, and the just mandate in general. What they don't understand is that the stuff that they like, the insurance companies are the ones who said, look, we can't do it unless we have everybody. We can't do the thing you want us to do unless we have everybody in the pool, so you're going to have to create a mandate. This isn't some crazy socialist idea that Barack Hussein Obama came up with. This is what the insurance company said. We don't know how to do it without healthy
The Heritage Foundation. But, okay, what we're talking about here is an economy. There's no simple way. You cannot pick and choose which parts go away and which parts stay. You know, one of the fears right now is that the private insurers that are very much a part of this, if there is a hard end date and they are at a point where do they re-up, do they sell for another year, and what they're looking at is a rush to get things done because people fear they're going to lose coverage, I predict you will see a lot of insurers get out of this. You are going to have chaos.
We've already had insurers get out of it.
You have, but there's going to be a rush to the exits. I mean, I think that's a valid concern. And again, this goes to Trump's inability or unwillingness to look at this as the complex creature that it is. And on the affordability thing, you know, saying this didn't deal with health care costs is a little bit like saying the current CEO of McDonald's hasn't really addressed the caloric intake of a Big Mac. There's a lot of factors driving health costs. It's probably unfortunate that the title of this act was the Affordable Care Act, because affordability, unless you're covered by the expansion of Medicaid, that's certainly an open question whether that's been achieved.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Can we just recognize, too, though, that those state exchanges were imploding before, you know, we even talked about repeal?
They were teetering. I don't know if they were imploding, but yes, to your point.
I would say they were imploding. Yeah. And I think, too, you know, the reason we're seeing this dramatic uptick is, you know, we were seeing a lot of that implosion in the news, and now we're not. And now it's just the great things about Obamacare that people are afraid of losing. And so I think that'll change as we go down the road.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a little bit of what's happening at the state level, including how we're going to grapple with the state budget. About a week ago today, Governor Malloy laid out his State of the State address. Coming up Monday, January 23rd, Colin and Mark Pazniokas will join a few of the Wheelhouse panelists with the stories behind the biggest stories of 2016 and the storms on the 2017 horizon. It's from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Lyceum in Hartford. If you want to find out more, it's CTFOG. It's ConnecticutFog.org. That's coming up Monday, January 23rd. We'll tweet out more information about that. Back with more on the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. We've been talking so much about national news because there's been so much of it. We haven't really talked about state news. Governor Malloy gives the State of the State address last week. We're staring squarely at a big budget deficit that we've been talking about. It's like a big iceberg that's been heading toward us for quite some time, Suzanne. Malloy refusing to rule out tax increases in a 40-minute interview in his office with Capitol reporters on Friday. That's something I know that the Yankee Institute has been talking a lot about. Talk about what Malloy should be doing right here. If we can't rule out tax increases, it may be because we've got such a big looming deficit that almost everything has got to be on the table, right?
I get the math. But, you know, look, we were here in 2011. We were here in 2015. We've had these two massive tax increases. And here we are again, right? I mean, every 2 years we're in the same spot. And I'm just sick of talking about tax increases without talking about these structural issues that we still are not getting at. And so until you put some of those structural issues on the table, really put them on the table and deal with them, how can you go back to the people of Connecticut and ask them for more money?
So talk about a structural issue specifically. I mean, what's something that we need to deal with before we start talking more tax increases?
Pension reform. We need to reform our pensions. We need to get salary and benefit realignment. Our state employees make on – I was just looking at some census data. Our state employees make on an average of $10,000 more than Massachusetts, $5,000 more than employees in New York and New Jersey. We need a realignment on this issue, and it's you know, is it on the table? We need a freeze on borrowing. Our debt service costs are outrageous, and we need to set some priorities in our budgets until they start dealing with these things that are at the root of all of our problems. How can you go back and ask the people of Connecticut for more money?
So here's my question, though, about negotiation vis-a-vis that. How do you negotiate over pension changes? How do you negotiate with state employees if you take off the table the notion that we might have to raise taxes? I mean, I don't think that anybody's going to want to go back to the table unless that is at least something that is out there in the offing.
Fine. So put all of those things on the table and then say to the state employees, who should we raise taxes on? The last time in 2015, we raised taxes on just the very
rich. I know
what
rich. They're going to say.
We had to – right, exactly. Raise taxes on the millionaires. Okay, so in 2015, we did that. We just raised taxes on people with incomes over $1 million for a family. And we had diminishing returns in our income tax receipts in the next year. If you wanted to fill a $1.5 billion hole on just the millionaires' backs, you would need to raise their tax rate to 14%. That's not – it's not going to happen. How do we get them to a place that's reasonable and understanding that this – the root of this problem is in these structural issues, and if we don't deal with them, we're going to have to keep coming back, and it's not going to be the millionaires. It's going to be the middle class that end up paying.
And here's one of the realities of this, Paz, is Suzanne's right. I mean, there have been diminishing returns on this. We keep seeing over and over again – quarter by quarter, tax receipts not coming in where they're supposed to be coming in. This is going years on end now. So we're not really getting the tax revenue that we had expected from the tax increases that we've instituted already. Our tax increase is something that should be on the table.
Well, I'll start where Suzanne started, but she quickly moved past it. You know, she said, I know the math. Well, okay, just stop there. And somewhere Keith Faniff is saying, yay, Mark listens. You cannot so glibly push past the math. The numbers are such that you're going to need revenue. The question is, what makes the most sense from a public policy point of view to get revenue that is stable, that has the least harm to the economy and to the populace at large? The last tax increase they tried on the very rich, you know, the idea of taking the top rate and having it apply from dollar one instead of the marginal income, it didn't work. And Marty Looney, the leader of the Senate, one of the most liberal people at the Capitol, says it didn't work. So his message to labor and all the people are saying tax the rich again is, folks, ideologically, I may agree with you, but at the end of the day, we need a tax structure
get us money.
That works. Yes. Well, that's – so yes, math is important here. The Republicans last time, much of their criticism of the Malloy budget and the Democratic legislature's budget had to do with cuts. There was outrage over budget cuts. You know, there's a reason that the Republicans are quietly saying, thank you, baby Jesus, for not giving me a majority.
I quickly want to hear from Colin on this and then let Suzanne respond. I think that actually math is important here, something that Barack Obama said in his speech last night. But anyway, please continue, Colin.
Well, I mean, you're both right, you know, and I can't disagree with Suzanne about anything that she said, really. That, like, I mean, I do feel... Okay, all three of you are right. I do feel you have to put everything on the table, you know. But I without sort of massive concessions or as she says, structural changes, we're just going to have the same conversation over and over and over again. I got an email from a guy who used to work in state government. Somebody who Paz might remember. I won't say who it is. He just moved back here. He said, I'm trying to figure out how our state budget is seven times what it was in 1980 when inflation is only up 2.9 times. And at a time when technology should be making some things cheaper, right? Something should get cheaper as a result of the digital explosion that we've had here in terms of billing and stuff like that. And it just isn't. So, yeah, I don't know. The only thing I would disagree with that's been said here so far is I don't feel as though the state budget is bearing down on me like a giant iceberg, John. I feel like it's bearing down on me like Suzanne's giant minivan. But I don't know. What is there to disagree about?
Suzanne, you wanted to respond?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it was interesting. I was listening to Mayor Luke Bronin yesterday, right? Mayor of Hartford, who is facing potential bankruptcy in his city because of a lot of the same structural issues. We have a study coming out.
No, it's a very different structural issues.
No, very actually.
His pension is the best pension.
77% funded.
It's one of the best in the state.
The debt service costs. I mean, right. So we have a study coming out next week called Connecticut's Broken Cities, where we had a Manhattan Institute scholar deep dive into the cities and why they're having a lot of these problems. And, you know, there are a lot of labor issues.
True.
You know, the power of union influence in the cities and at the state level is very strong. And they have managed to get things set in law, you know, benefits set in law that the rest of us would never dream of. Look, in other states, it's sort of like normal for collective bargaining to be done behind closed doors. In Connecticut, it's by law, it has to be. They're not allowed to talk about it. That's a transparency issue right there. I mean, for years, the Connecticut taxpayer has been shut out of so many of these decisions. And until you get at that influence, right, at some of these structural root problems, we're going to come back here 2 years from now. Fine, put revenue on the table, and then what? What happens to our growth, right? I mean, we're not growing, and eventually we have to grow our way out of this problem. How do we do that and raise taxes again?
Yeah, just real quick, Hartford so rarely gets defended by anybody. Their pension was 106% funded until the stock market crash of 2008. But yes, to Suzanne's point, they made some really bad decisions, Pedro Segarra did, on debt, on refinancing debt. But Hartford, the heart of Hartford's problem is they have no taxable property. It is 50% tax exempt. There are structural issues. But some of the labor stuff, it's effective. How effectively can you run the city? Can you get the freedom to move people around? There are a bunch of very legitimate issues, but I would push back. As somebody who covered Hartford for a long time, you can blow up all of Hartford's labor agreements, and Hartford still has sort of an existential financial problem.
Well, so hold it. Colin, existential financial problems at the city level, in the state capital, and then at the state level as well. So the state's not going to be able to help Hartford get out of its mess. Hartford seemingly isn't going to help the state get out of its mess.
Help me, Superman. No, I mean, it's an ugly picture. I guess what I would say is, once again, I mean, I think it's true that both of you are right. Suzanne's right that at the state level there are structural problems, which if not addressed will just cause us to dig the same hole over and over again. You know, Paz is right too that Hartford has a different kind of structural problem that may need a different kind of redress and a different kind of understanding, particularly in terms of the tax-exempt properties that are here that everybody uses in Wethersfield and Simsbury and West Hartford and stuff like that. And unless we think about that differently and think about the fact that Hartford is this tiny little, you know, geographical, it's a postage stamp, 15, 16 square miles, not really reflective of a metro area. You know, the stuff that Bronin is trying to do, I don't think he's going to make a lot of headway, but he should be able to make a lot of headway if people thought clearly about this. Our destinies are all tied together.
We have a very little bit of time. You seem to not buy this notion at all.
No, because, look, half of Hartford's budget already comes from the state, and that's a lot more than has happened but Hartford has not changed some of its practices in terms of benefits, and like other cities are making these hard changes. You know, they're going to high deductible health savings account plans for their employees. They're
other
going
cities
to 401ks.
In Connecticut?
Oh, lots of other cities in Connecticut. Danbury's done a lot of things. South Windsor. I mean, look, Stamford. A lot of cities are making these changes. But the union influence in Hartford, it's very hard to combat this. Now, to Luke Bronin's credit, he just got a really great deal with the firefighters, and good for him, and we need to see more of that. But again, unless you get to these structural issues, it's not just a revenue problem. You have some real structural issues in Hartford that need to be addressed.
And Paz, we just have a minute left, but I have to say, here's how we're going to solve some of the structural problems at the state and the local level. We're going to get a lot more money because now finally we've got a casino deal that's barreling down on us. The Mashantucket Pequots and Mohegans are working with Governor Malloy. What's happening on the casino front?
I'm happy to report it's already stimulated the economy. By my count, in the last 2 years, there's probably been close to $3 million spent on lobbyists in Hartford. And so that translates into food, drink, and God knows what. This is the year which they're going to finally make a decision. Ignore a lot of the noise that MGM is raising. I mean, they're in it because they want to kill the competition. But the Connecticut Charter Assembly is going to have to decide, do they really want to do this year?
So coming up later on today, a Donald Trump press conference, we think, at 11 o'clock, about an hour from now. The Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock today, in which we're going to discuss some of the things that we hear in Donald Trump's press conference. That'll be rebroadcast tonight at 7 o'clock. Then at 8 o'clock, a special from NPR about all the news that's going on. There is way too much to cover this week with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and also our own Colin McEnroe. Thank you all very much for joining us. Our technical producer is Kyle Wolf. Heather Brandon is the digital editor. The executive producer is Katie Schalarsky. And thanks to the cameras of CTN for keeping us company today. This is The Wheelhouse.